It is my honor to introduce to you my good friend, Anthony Gregory. He writes for LouRockwell.com, AntiWar.com, StrikeTheRoot.com, Liberty Magazine, The Future of Freedom Foundation, which you can find at FFF.org, Rational Review, and The Libertarian Enterprise. On top of that, he's a research assistant at the Independent Institute in Oakland. Welcome to the show, Anthony.
Hi. Good to be here.
Hey, it's great to have you back on. Oh, man, you wrote this article for LouRockwell.com yesterday. I hope it's still up there on the front page somewhere. Called Government Growth, the Party of Lincoln, and George W. Bush.
Wow. That's right.
What a piece that was.
Thanks.
So, what's your point? What are you getting at, the Party of Lincoln and George W. Bush?
Well, I'm used to hearing from conservatives and from some libertarians, too, that Bush needs to go back, that Bush has betrayed the principles of small government that the Republican Party supposedly has upheld for so long. And I've heard people on the left say that he's betrayed the legacy of Lincoln, and the Republicans have betrayed the principles of Lincoln for a long time. I think that both of these assumptions are false. I think the party of the Republican Party has always been a big government party. There have been tiny historical anomalies where the parties appeared to be better than the Democrats, but they're mostly anomalies, and they're easily explained, or maybe not so easily, but they're usually illusory. It's not real. It's an illusion. And likewise, this has been the major principle of the party since Lincoln. It's always been a big government party.
Well, and I think we need to get back to some history here and figure out where exactly does the Republican Party come from in the first place?
Well, if you want to go back a long time to the American Revolution, it occurred and the American colonies freed themselves from Britain. And soon after that, and in fact during the Revolution, there was a huge debate in America over which direction it should go as far as government. Should we have a strong central government that engages in central banking, or at least has a national bank that funds certain ventures at home, that has a strong standing army, that it has a lot of power over the citizens, or at least potentially a lot of power? And those were the Federalists, which is what they were called. And that's somewhat a misnomer, because they were actually against federalism in the good sense of decentralization. That's what federalism really means. But they co-opted the name, and at any rate, they were called the Federalists.
I love it. They're based on a deception from the very beginning.
Yeah, from
Please
the very
continue,
beginning.
Yeah.
They were Orwell, way before his time. And there was the Federalists, and they became the Federalist Party. And they were represented by people like Hamilton. And then on the other side of the aisle, you had people who tended to believe in more liberty and less central state power, and they were called the Anti-Federalists before the Constitution was ratified, and they more or less became the Jeffersonians. And I mean, this is all kind of generalization here, but the Jeffersonians more or less were the Democratic Party of somewhat smaller government. They all had their mistakes and errors and flaws.
Oh, hang tight right there. We're at the split between the Hamiltonians and the Jeffersonians. The guest is Anthony Gregory. Read what he writes. I'm not kidding. It's a weekend interview show. We'll be right back. All right, everybody, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton, your host. And the guest is Anthony Gregory. He's only 23 years old, but is sure to go down in history as one of the great libertarian thinkers of the order of Ludwig von Mises, Murray Rothbard, and Lou Rockwell. You can watch his career closely at anthonygregory.com, and I especially urge all of you to go and read this kid's writings at lourockwell.com, antiwar.com, striketheroot.com. There's dashes in between strike the and the root there. And the Future Freedom Foundation as well. The kid writes incredible stuff, incredible stuff. So anyways, sorry for talking so good about you there. I don't mean to make you embarrassed, Anthony.
Yeah, that's fine.
But no, I mean, really, I read Government Growth, The Party of Lincoln and George W. Bush, and oh my God, I got to get him back on the show. Okay, so when we left off, Hamilton had co-opted the name Federalist. In his usage, it meant Centralist. And Jefferson, Madison, and the Jeffersonian Republicans had broken off from them and become the opposition. And then what happened?
Well, you know, it's tough to reduce all of this history in such short time. But basically, the Federalist Party and the Hamiltonians continued, you know, with central banking. They kept introducing a national bank. They kept wanting the government to fund projects. And eventually the Federalist Party dissolved and more or less became the Whig Party, which had the same kind of mentality. And the Democratic Party this time, of course, wasn't perfect. I mean, it was a political party, and their presidents weren't perfect because they were presidents. But, you know, from the Democratic Party, you get things like, you get people like Martin Van Buren, who's pretty good. He definitely had his flaws, but he was pretty good. You got Thomas Jefferson, who did a lot of bad things as president, but, you know, he would repeal the Alien and Sedition Acts. They were generally on the better side, the Democrats. And the Whig Party, or the Federalist Party, and then the Whig Party were the bad side. Now, the Whig Party eventually fell apart because in all of the debates between the political discourse in the antebellum era was all muddled by a lot of issues. Slavery and the issue of talking about slavery made the standard political institutions fall apart. And it's a complicated history, but the Whig Party fell apart. And there were, you know, that people were clamoring for a new party. And there was something that was called the Free Soil Movement, and the Free Soil Party. Now, on the one hand, they sounded like they had some good ideas because they didn't want slavery in the Western territories. And, of course, slavery is the opposite of freedom. But they were mostly against slavery, and this is what they said, in the Western territories, because they thought black slaves wouldn't be able to compete or would out-compete free white laborers. And they didn't want blacks in the West at all, more or less.
So it wasn't that they gave single care at all about the rights of blacks. It was basically protectionism for their jobs.
Well, there were abolitionists and anti-slavery folks in the movement, but institutionally, the Free Soil Movement was mainly concerned, and it became increasingly so, especially when the Free Soil Party dissolved and the Republican Party was founded. The main concern was internal improvement, which was this idea that Henry Clay came up with. It was called the American system, where the federal government would fund railroads, canals, there'd be high protectionist tariffs. And in general, the South didn't like this kind of stuff because they would have to pay a lot of the tariffs, and they would probably benefit less from the so-called internal improvements. And a lot of the reason they wanted to keep slavery out of the West was just because they wanted to have power in the Senate. And there were a lot of reasons, but their main unifying factor, especially when Lincoln came in 1860 in the Republican movement, it was all about establishing this kind of corporatist state, this kind of neo-mercantilism within the country. And during the Lincoln's War, that's mainly what happened. And slavery didn't even come up until about halfway into the war. And Lincoln had his phony Emancipation Proclamation, which only applied to territories he didn't control. So it didn't apply at all, and it was just a trick. And the North, of course, had slavery in a few states all the way up until a couple years after the Civil War. So the main issue there was empowering the federal government. And Lincoln was the biggest government president that the country had seen up to that point, certainly. And whatever can be said about the, I would say, incidental effect of the end of slavery from the war, and the later the 13th Amendment, this was all, this wasn't their main interest. And certainly you can't consider Lincoln to be anything like a Jeffersonian or anything to be like the kind of guy that the better half of the Founding Fathers would have wanted to associate with. So from the beginning of the Republican Party, once they took power, they were a big government party, and they continued in the late 19th century with Reconstruction, which, of course, there were probably people who had good intentions, like there often are in politics, even in authoritarian or totalitarian regimes. Some people have good intentions, but it was mostly a scam, and the Republicans more or less turned the country into a single-party state for a while, and they had dictatorships in the South, basically, for a while, and until Reconstruction finally ended in 1876. And from then on, the party continued being the big government party.
So we basically have, in Abraham Lincoln and the Republican Party of the Civil War and post-Civil War days, we have a continuation from Hamilton through Henry Clay and then into Abraham Lincoln and then the post-Lincolnian Republicans. Is that right?
Sure. And again, I want to stress that there were probably good Republicans, but it wasn't a small government party by any stretch of the imagination. It was the biggest government the colonies had ever seen. What Lincoln did with, you know, shooting draft resistors, civilians, and this total war in some places, and the censorship. He closed down papers, and he issued fiat money for the big time, and imposed an income tax. I mean, this wasn't a small government party then, and during Reconstruction it wasn't. And by the time the 20th century came along, well, actually at the end of the 19th century, William McKinley, a Republican, was the first to take the U.S. onto the road of global empire with the Spanish-American War. And Teddy Roosevelt, of course, continued this trend, as did Taft. The Republican, the progressive movement, up until Wilson in 1912, was all Republicans. I mean, I don't want to say it's all Republicans, but the people in power that brought the U.S. to become an interventionist foreign power and also brought the U.S. government to intervene in the economy with tax, with the income tax and central banking and regulation of the Pure Food and Drug Act and all of these regulations, these labor laws, the graduated income tax, and the intervention in Latin America and the Philippines. Under Teddy Roosevelt, of course, U.S. killed about 200,000 Philippine, I guess these days they'd be called insurgents, but they were civilians, and some were as young as 11. They were ordered to shoot them. I mean, the U.S. became quite brutal in its foreign policy, and the government became quite interventionist in the economy, starting with the Republican progressives. And Teddy Roosevelt was and he's been called this favorably. He was kind of America's first neocon, and you rarely hear Republicans today denounce him or denounce Lincoln or any of these guys. And so
this point, the Democrats had been the party of small government and decentralization and that kind of thing.
Sure.
And the Republicans were the party of the Northeastern liberal establishment that wanted to use the power of government to get things done.
Yeah, I guess you could say that. The Democrats, probably one of the best presidents or least bad presidents we've had was Grover Cleveland. And that was the 1890s, or 1880s and 1890s. He had two non-consecutive terms. And he was before McKinley. And he, you know, he strengthened the gold standard, and he vetoed bills like crazy. Of course, our current Republican president hasn't vetoed anything, but Grover Cleveland vetoed like mad, and he was, of course, he wasn't perfect. He was a president, but he was the last president we've had that's even close to a constitutionalist in the in the real sense of the term. That's what I would say anyway.
So then what happened with the election in 1912? Because that was supposed to be Taft's second term then, right?
Well, in 1912, William Howard Taft, who's often called a laissez-faire president, lyingly, he wasn't. He accelerated antitrust suits, and he lobbied hard and hard for the income tax, and he finally got Congress to ratify the amendment. But he used government in ways that certain business interests didn't like. So they helped Teddy Roosevelt with his Progressive Party, which was also a big government corporatist, almost socialist party. It was bad news. And so in 1912, we have Teddy Roosevelt and Taft, and Wilson was a Democrat, and some of the stuff Wilson said was still on the old Jeffersonian stuff. He was more concerned, if this makes any sense, he seemed more concerned with big business being cut down than government growing to accommodate it. But you know, of course, when Wilson became president, and some of this can even be blamed on what the Republicans had done to move the country toward a pro-government bias.
Hold on right there. We'll be right back with Woodrow Wilson. We're talking with Anthony Gregory from LouRockwell.com. It's the Weekend Interview Show. Everybody, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Scott Horton. The website for the show, if you want to check out any of the archives of the past interviews I've done, is weekendinterviewshow.com, and I encourage you all to go and check that out. And also, please check out anthonygregory.com. He is our guest for this hour, and we're learning from him about how the Republicans have always been the party of big government. Anthony?
Hi. Well, yeah, and it continued to this. Woodrow Wilson was the first really big government Democrat, and he continued expanding the government at home, and then eventually dragged the country into war in Europe, World War One, and that of course made the Republicans look better in comparison, perhaps because he was so bad. But in the 1920s, after Wilson, there was kind of a return to normalcy, as Harding put it, and with Presidents Harding and Coolidge. And they did bring government back down to size from World War One, but it was never as small as it was before World War One. So it was still bigger than it was under the Progressive Era. And they did some good things. Their Treasury Secretary, Andrew Mellon, was really sane, and they cut taxes and spending. But Not enough, and they were also they were for big government in other areas. Of course, they enforced alcohol prohibition and protectionist trade policies, and Coolidge was still an interventionist in Latin America. And Herbert Hoover, who became president in 28, or was elected in 28, he threw out the illusion that Republicans were a party of small government. He threw it out the window with a stock market crash. He created the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, the Home Loan Board, I think it's called.
Wait, but Anthony, I thought that the reason that FDR beat him was because he refused to do anything about the Great Depression, and everybody knew that the government had to do something about the problem.
Well, that's a myth. Hoover increased government so much, being a big government Republican, and FDR ran against him on a campaign of cutting government and balancing budgets, reducing spending, and FDR ran as kind of a Jeffersonian light in his rhetoric. Of course, when he became president,
he was Woodrow Wilson heavy once he became president.
Yeah, he was Woodrow Wilson heavy. His New Deal was basically World War One domestically, and World War Two, of course, the government grew enormously, and a lot of Republicans criticized the New Deal during the 30s, probably because they were the minority party. But World War II and all of the domestic stuff FDR did that was bad, the Republicans stopped criticizing. And the Republicans became, you know, they kind of made peace with FDR. They made peace with Truman, And Eisenhower, you know, again, he looked good in comparison to Truman and FDR, but that's not hard. And so throughout the 50s, it was the Republicans were in power. It was kind of deceptive to think that it was small government. It's still big government. And
as you point out in your article, Eisenhower is the one who had the coup in Iran.
Yeah, and that was what really sparked U.S. intervention in the Middle East. The Republicans liked taking us to new places in foreign policy, and they took us to the Middle East, which has obviously not been a good thing. They overthrew the Iranian democratically elected leader, and the Shah was in. And when the Shah was overthrown, the Iranians were mad, and we had the Ayatollah, and that's why our government funded Saddam Hussein, and it was a mess. And Eisenhower started it. He was still probably better than Truman and FDR, but he was still big government president. And in the 60s, Goldwater, of course, appeared to be a small government president, but he was a big cold warrior, and his rhetoric changed when he wasn't running for office. And Lyndon Johnson again made the Republicans look better. The only time the Republicans ever look good is when they're not in power. And Lyndon Johnson was a big government guy with the Vietnam War and Great Society, but Nixon continued all of that. Nixon continued the Great Society. He created the EPA and OSHA. Nixon imposed wage and price controls, which are very destructive to the economy. Nixon, you know, carpet bombed Cambodia. He lied. He advocated a total handgun ban. He never enacted it, thank goodness. But
well, we all know Richard Nixon was a socialist. Even Republicans hate him. But what about Ronald Reagan? He's the champion of small government republicanism, Anthony.
Well, that's one of the biggest myths of all. Ronald Reagan, you know, he used to talk. He became famous talking about free enterprise because he worked for a government contractor. But he was never, which told him to go around talking about it. But it wasn't real free enterprise. He was a New Dealer, and as governor of California, he enacted the highest tax increase in California history. He gave us income tax withholding. He signed the Mulford Act, which was one of the worst gun control laws in California history, also authored by a Republican. And Reagan was a way bigger president than Carter before him, or even Clinton in the 90s. Reagan almost doubled the size of government. I mean, spending went through the roof, regulations went through the roof, protectionist trade went through the roof. Reagan intervened in all of these countries and bombs people, and he pumped up the war on drugs, of course. The war on drugs went... It is amazing how the federal prison population of drug offenders just escalated exponentially under Reagan.
All right, we're going out to break here. The guest is Anthony Gregory, and we'll be right back to talk about the Bushes. Go to LouRockwell.com and read what Anthony Gregory writes. It will help and make you smart. Everybody, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Scott Horton, and the guest is Anthony Gregory. He's got sure a heck of a sharp mind on him, and he writes for many different publications, including LouRockwell.com, Antiwar.com. He writes for the Independent Institute, where he is a research assistant. He writes for StrikeTheRoot.com, which I urge everybody to go to StrikeTheRoot.com. Today, where Anthony is the guest editor of that page, and that's Strike the Root with dashes between those words. He also writes for Liberty Magazine and the Future Freedom Foundation, that's FFF.org. And he also writes for Rational Review and the Libertarian Enterprise. Now, we've been discussing his recent column that he wrote for LouRockwell.com called Government Growth, the Party of Lincoln and George W. Bush. And if you missed the last half hour, boy, it was amazing. We went from Alexander Hamilton through Henry Clay, Abraham Lincoln, the Reconstruction era, McKinley, Taft, Coolidge, Harding, and Hoover. And Then we talked about Ike Eisenhower, Richard Nixon, and Ronald Reagan, and how consistently, all the way through, the Republican Party has been the party of big government from the Northeast. That, according to Anthony Gregory, any time that the Republicans seemed as though they were the party of conservatism and small government, it was only because they were out of power and maybe looked good compared to the Democrats, but in fact were no good at all. And he just finished explaining how Ronald Reagan expanded the size of government faster than anyone since FDR. And
well, Ronald Reagan, I wouldn't say that.
Oh,
I
mean, no? Who expanded it faster than FDR besides Reagan?
Well, both Johnson and Nixon were probably worse on that front than FDR. And though Truman didn't accelerate it fast, he kept it going pretty fast. Reagan, since Nixon, all of the Republican presidents have been the biggest government ones. Nixon and Reagan and the two Bushes, actually, have all been bigger government presidents than Carter or Clinton. Now, I'm not saying that these Democrats are good, especially Clinton. He was terrible. He did a lot of really terrible things. But the Republicans have actually been worse for small government and better for big government than the Democrats. That's what I would say. And Reagan was this way, and the Bush Sr. was this way. Bush Sr. Signed the Americans with Disabilities Act, which is enormously destructive to the free market. It's ridiculous. And
when you write in your column about George Bush that he blew the biggest opportunity imaginable.
Yeah. The U.S. Foreign policy became increasingly interventionist in the 20th century. And in the Cold War, the big excuse was because of the Soviets. Now, when the Soviet Union fell, the U.S. could have taken credit however dishonestly. And it was communism that killed itself. But, you know, Bush Sr. could have said, we've defeated communism, I'm bringing the troops home. And a lot of the better conservatives kind of wanted him to do that. Of course, he didn't do that. He went to war with Iraq over a bunch of lies.
And Panama,
sure. That was a part of the drug war, and that was devastating, too. And he went to war with Iraq, which, just like Eisenhower got us involved in Iran, Bush, we were involved with Iraq, but Saddam was a U.S. ally until then, really. And that was obviously a big disaster. Of course, Bush Sr. also didn't do anything to punish his ATF and FBI agents who killed innocent people at Ruby Ridge. But a lot of conservatives forget that and like to think that Ruby Ridge happened on Clinton's watch. It was Bush Sr. And, of course, Bush II has been the biggest disaster for the principles of limited government probably since Johnson and Nixon and the Vietnam Great Society days. Certainly, he created the Department of Homeland Security, and he enacted the Patriot Act, and we've had two wars in the last 4 years. And, you know, the Bill of Rights has taken a major beating, and government spending has climbed at about 8%, I believe, a year, which is about twice that under Clinton. And that's defense spending and non-defense spending. It's all spending. And the prescription drug benefit was the largest expansion in the welfare state since Lyndon Johnson. And the Farm Bill was the biggest farm bill in his agricultural welfare. And his tariffs, he's imposed lots of tariffs. And he's the No Child Left Behind. And his, federal education spending under Bush has climbed about 50%. We've seen government grow so much under him. I mean, it almost makes people who really believe in small government, conservatives who think that they really believe in small government, should look at Bush. He's worse than Clinton on government. He's made it much, much bigger, just across the board.
Well, let's go through this a little bit in a little bit more detail here, Anthony. I feel that it is my duty, as a man with a radio show this close to the national election, to, you know, I know that my voice isn't that loud, but as loud as it is, I need to use it in order to hurt the incumbent as much as I possibly can. And so I'd really like to spend the next 20 minutes or so with you here just basically ripping George Bush to shreds in the manner that he really deserves. Now, you know, if you skip the first 9 months of his administration and you go right to September 11th, he knew on the way to the school, he was informed that a plane had hit the tower and said, oh boy, well, it sounds like a terrible accident. I'm sure that's probably what most people thought. The fact that he'd been briefed that bin Laden was planning an attack with airplanes on August 6th, notwithstanding, it didn't occur to him, of course, that this could possibly be an attack. But then after being told that a second plane had hit the second tower and that, quote, Andy Card, the chief of staff, America is under attack, he sat and did nothing for a full 7 minutes before he even got up to leave the schoolroom.
Well, sure, and I mean, I might prefer that he would have that he would have done nothing for the last 4 years.
But, yeah, it would have been better if he just stayed in that schoolroom the whole time, huh?
Yeah, but that's true, and he, you know, there's people. I think have this false memory on 9/11 that Bush really, everyone said that Bush really rise to the occasion, but I wasn't very impressed at the time with his speech and all that.
Well, he fled in cowardly terror to Louisiana and then to Nebraska and didn't even make it back to Washington, D.C. until 8 o'clock that night.
Sure, and yeah, that's true. And since then, his response, I mean, that day, you might say that he was cowardly or a little bit shaken up and unpresidential. You could say whatever you want, but what he's done after that day in response to 9/11 is certainly far worse. It's been a disaster.
Well, and we just heard this clip of him announcing the creation of the September 11th Commission. That was after Dick Cheney had called Tom Daschle and Trent Lott, Tom Daschle and Dennis Hastert, and told them there were not going to be any investigations. And then the families protested so loud that finally Congress began an investigation. But after dragging their feet on that, and Congress saying deliberately in their report that the government withheld information from us all the way up until the last day, so this report isn't complete. So then the families screamed some more, and they finally got a independent commission. And you just heard in that clip, when Bush announced the creation of the September 11th Commission, that the entire point of the commission was to make recommendations for how to make government more powerful. It was always an outcome-based commission. It had nothing to do with finding the truth of why it happened. It had everything to do with making recommendations that we can act on. The quicker, the better.
Well, yeah, these commissions are just a smokescreen. It's like the commission that got together and talked about Waco. Their purpose was to absolve the government of responsibility, and that's their purpose. The purpose, you know, it's the commission. They don't ever even discuss issues of how perhaps U.S. foreign policy is causing more problems than it's solving. It's not even on the table to discuss, and the 9/11 Commission has just been, it's really just a hoax.
Well, and as I found out on this show last week, interviewing Sybil Edmonds, that she had specific information about a warning received in April of 2001 that there was an attack involving airplanes coming soon. Didn't have the word hijacking. It said an attack with airplanes. And she told the September 11th Commission about it, and yet it didn't even make the slightest mention in the report.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised. Of course, there's a good chapter in Jim Bovard's book, The Bush Betrayal, about all this cover-up stuff, the smokescreen stuff, and how the commission, you know, how secretive Bush has been, and how the administration hasn't, they don't want any real investigation. But that's not uncommon. And as bad as that is, I think that what the Bush administration has done at home and overseas to supposedly stop this the terrorist threat is just, it's probably the worst thing our government's embarked on in years.
Well, don't you think they needed to go in there and overthrow the Taliban? After all, they refused to hand over bin Laden.
Well, you hear, you know, it's almost accepted that that war was just, even people who criticize Iraq war often don't criticize Afghanistan. But the Taliban was they were willing to negotiate with certain terms, and instead of even attempting a serious negotiation process, they went to war. And of course, Kerry is kind of right that militarily they screwed up by letting the he likes to say outsourcing, but you know, by putting the job and putting, I guess, our enemy in charge of retrieving our other enemies.
Right.
And so it was a disaster. And of course, Afghanistan's not liberated. They say that Bush has liberated, 50 million people or whatever in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's a lie. Afghanistan's horrible now.
Well, even if they haven't created a wonderful democracy there, at least three quarters of Al-Qaeda's leadership have been killed, right, Anthony?
Well, you know, they say that a lot, don't they? But Al-Qaeda is restructuring, and a lot of people are joining the ranks, and it's unclear if this is a global war on terror, where Al-Qaeda stops and other networks begins. It's becoming more decentralized, and I would say no. I'd say there's more terrorists willing to attack America now than there probably ever was, and that's what's really important, right? So... No, it's been a disaster. Of course, the Iraq war has been a disaster, and tens of thousands of innocent people have been killed, and we've lost over 1,000 American servicemen and women. And this isn't making us safer, and neither is the Patriot Act, neither is getting rid of the Fourth Amendment. Bush is a big government president on economic issues, on domestic issues and foreign policy issues, on surveillance issues. I can't imagine how anyone who pretends to believe in liberty and smaller government would support him. Of course, I'm not advocating anyone support his opponent, who appears to be basically the same. But I can't see how someone could stand through 4 years of this and think that this is the best we can do. This is the smaller, you know, this is the smaller government party. It's never been, and that's clear as day with the Bush administration.
Well, it should be said, too, there's some other reasons for voting against George Bush, if not for John Kerry. If John Kerry wins, then that means that Hillary Clinton won't be able to run for president until 2012. And she'll be way old and ugly by then if she's not already.
Well, it's true that, you know, it's hard to know what would happen, but I've heard that theory that some have said that, you know, the Clintons might actually want Kerry to lose, but... I don't know about that. I do know that if Kerry's president, a possible silver lining will be that it'll be a divided government again. The government has grown slowest since Nixon, when we've had a Democratic president and Republican Congress. Now, that doesn't guarantee a trend to continue, but the idea that Kerry's going to come in and expand government... When Clinton wanted to expand government, the Republicans fought him and pretended they cared about the Constitution and liberty, but they don't do that now. They go along with what the president wants. The president goes along with what they want and what their voting blocs want. If it's a divided Congress, or if the Congress stays Republican and Kerry becomes president, I could see government getting bigger at a slower rate, but we never know. And, of course, there's basically bipartisan agreement on the war. So...
What do you think is a libertarian small government solution to the war on terrorism, Anthony?
Well, I would say that we...
I should have asked you that going out to the break. Hang tight right there, man. We'll be right back. It's the Weekend Interview Show. The guest is Anthony Gregory. Everybody, check out thebumpersticker.com for the best in anti-war, anti-state propaganda. Bumper stickers such as "The Constitution didn't change on September 11th. Contradict authority. Government causing more violence than it presents since 10,000 BC. And I still can't decide who I'm least against." There are over 400 stickers, all of them denouncing state power, at thebumpersticker.com. So if you want to help keep this young anarchist eating food and doing interviews, please help me make some money and at the same time stick some anti-state propaganda on the back of your vehicle. It's TheBumperSticker.com. All right, everybody, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Scott Horton, and the guest is Anthony Gregory. He's one of the brightest young libertarian writers in the whole wide world. You can read what he writes at lewrockwell.com, antiwar.com. Boy, the last one he wrote for antiwar.com was so good. It was called Anti-War Reasons for Supporting War or something. Anti-war, pro-war arguments. It was great. Anyway, you can read what he writes at theindependentinstitute.org. StrikeTheRoot.com, Liberty Magazine, the Future of Freedom Foundation, that's FFF.org, and he also writes for Rational Review and the Libertarian Enterprise. Now, we're talking about how the Republican Party was always the party of big government, and still is, and why George W. Bush is, at least in my estimation, the worst president since Woodrow Wilson, and deserves nothing but to be resoundingly defeated this Tuesday.
Well, I would say the Democrat Party is also a party of big government, but the Republican Party is perhaps a party of even bigger government under using rhetoric of freedom and small government to do it, which is really bad for the cause of liberty. And, of course, you know, Bush is, if there was ever any doubts about this, you just look at what Bush has done. You know, he cut taxes. But he only cut taxes a little bit, and it's not really a tax cut, because every time they spend money, they have to get it from somewhere. They have to either borrow or they have to inflate the dollar. And all of these, any spending increase is a tax increase. Bush is a tax increaser. He's just done it in hidden ways.
So instead of being a tax and spend liberal, he's a borrow and spend Republican.
Sure. He's a spend and spend Republican. And he likes... you know, a lot of people think that his wars are keeping us safer, and it's not. I mean, he lies about Medicare to congressmen when trying to get him to expand his subsidy, and he lies.
Explain that. How did he lie to Congress? What did he do?
Well, he called them up and told them that it would cost about $400 billion, and he knew that it would cost more. His administration knew it, and, of course, that estimate went up after they passed it to something like $580 billion or something, but in truth, it'll probably cost $1 trillion or $2 trillion. It's a huge expansion of the welfare state under a Republican.
All right, well, is it already a minute to go? Oh, I'm sorry, I thought I had a little bit more time there. Well, I guess that's it. Anthony Gregory, thank you very much for joining me on the show. I hope everybody goes out and votes against George W. Bush this Tuesday. Any closing comments? Make them quick.
Well, but, you know, the Republicans are a party of corporate welfare statism and war. It's a warfare welfare state, and Bush is just that way. I don't think Kerry will necessarily be any better, but those who believe in small government liberty, if they vote for Bush, they're just fooling themselves.
Very good. Thank you very much, Anthony. Everybody, please go read what Anthony Gregory writes. His website is anthonygregory.com. He also writes for lewrockwell.com, antiwar.com, striketheroot.com, fff.org, and many other type things like that. Please go and read what he writes. It'll make you smart. Thanks again for coming on.